Informed and unspun. This is The Big Picture.
Hello and welcome back to The Big Picture for our first show after a long summer break. I'm your host, Seb Bench. We hope you've all had an enjoyable summer and are ready again for an insightful and informative debate courtesy of our panel, which for our first debate includes...
Kira Merchandani-Cooper.
Luke, I'm a second year law student.
Rod, I'm a first year theology student.
And David, I'm a PhD student studying criminal justice.
Thank you. This week, the panel will be debating the summer's three of the summer's biggest issues, starting with university admissions. If you have any comments or questions regarding anything our panel says tonight, please don't hesitate to text or message in. You can text on 07762 212 434, or send us a free web text at urn1350.net. We look forward to hearing what you think. Now, on to our first topic, which is university admission numbers. University applications increased by 19,000 this year, but remained far below the pre-tuition fee rise peak. Prior to the fee increase, applications had steadily risen for years. The impact of the fee rise on applications was a great area of debate when the fees were increased, especially the impact on those from disadvantaged backgrounds. Therefore, with this in mind, does the panel think that the fee increase will have a long-term impact on university admissions? Luke?
I think any impact that the tuition fee change has had on admissions is ultimately going to be down to the scaremongering that went on about it and the people that were trying to make out that if you were to somehow go to university, you'd have to take out the equivalent of a mortgage in order to pay it back. What actually happened was some pretty fair reforms. I think people are starting to realise that now. And now that we've lost a lot of the Labour Party and similar other sorts of campaigns against tuition fees that actually cast a lot of misinformation about it, I think people are actually realising it's a decent investment in their future and well worthwhile.
I got to say, Luke, I think you're being a bit glib there, to be honest. I don't think that there was as much scaremongering as the people on the right claimed that there was. They very much misrepresented, I feel, the people who were coming out against the £9,000 debate. Yes, there were people who were falsely claiming that you would have to pay your fees up front. Yes, there were people who were claiming various misinformation. But it remained the case that there was a lot of very valid criticism around the time of the 2011-2012 changes, which I think you're quite right did put a lot of people off, and for good reason. I think we're seeing an increase in numbers now because it's not as current in people's minds, because there's still a lot of societal, cultural, institutional pressures that push 18-year-olds towards university, particularly from well-off middle-class families, of which there are still a few in this country. And various other sort of institutional factors, which tends to promote growth in university admission rates, much as there was a growth in university admission rates between the years when they doubled the tuition fees up to 3,000 and when they tripled them up to 9,000.
I have to say, I kind of agree. I think that actually the fact that they haven't gone back to pre-tuition fee levels actually shows that there are a lot of people still being put off by the prices, purely because they cannot afford them and do not see a prospect in the future where they will be able to pay back the money.
Yeah, I think it's very easy to talk about people not being being put off by tuition fee rates, but I think Luke's right in saying that tuition fees actually don't have that effect. And I think the reason that they haven't returned to those fee bonds, I disagree with Luke on that point, is that actually people are still misinformed about the effect that these tuition fees have.
Well, they certainly are. And again, it's going back to the idea that people can't afford to go to university. That's part of this whole thing. There's no reason why people should not be able to invest in their future according to a system that's going to see them paying back their money at a more sustainable and in a more fair manner than they were before, according to how much they're earning, not paying it back. I believe it's £21,000. If they're earning below £21,000 a year, they won't be paying anything back. It's a system that actually makes university... okay, it's more expensive, but the way you can pay it back is in a fairer manner that should actually be encouraged, and it should be that side of things that means people shouldn't be put off from the university. But as long as we're saying the idea that it's too expensive, that's going to keep putting people off.
I think there are factors that are putting people off, but I don't think it's down to misinformation. Again, it still remains the fact, the case that, for instance, if you look at statistics, there are... statistics that say that female applicants on average will never pay off their student debt in 9 out of 10 cases. Now, obviously, you can say these are statistics. They're based on, they're damn lies and statistics, but also that they're based on very, very tenuous data. But it remains the case that there are a lot of factors, particularly, for instance, surrounding women in the workplace, things like maternity leave, leaving the vocation that you're in to start a family. That's still very much the norm in this country, and that puts people in a position where they're signing on to be in debt to for the rest of their life to their government. And I think people are leery of that. People are staying away from that. And it's interesting also to note that the number of English student applications to Scottish universities, where the tuition fee hike hasn't happened yet, have significantly increased in the same period.
All I'd say, I think, is that the bit of that that perhaps was particularly true, David, is the idea that people are seeing university somehow as necessary. And what I got from that and what you were saying is that people are potentially going to university only to get themselves in a lot of debt that's ultimately unnecessary. And I do think that we shouldn't have this automatic system where university is seen as an extension of education, that people should be encouraged as they are into other fields, such as apprenticeships and that sort of thing.
So women shouldn't go to university because they're going to go and have
children? No, sorry, I was taking the point that you'd said, that was that there are a lot of people who are going to university. I maybe misunderstood you, but the point that I took you as saying was that a lot of people going to university who shouldn't necessarily have to go there, and there are alternative routes that they can follow, and one of those routes would be through an apprenticeship, which is increasing. I don't know, maybe that's had a negligible effect on the university admissions, but I think it's more the idea that people shouldn't have to get themselves into debt at this stage if it's not necessary, and that they should look at these alternative ways that can actually make them money rather than immediately put them in a position where they're having to pay it back.
I think one of the reasons that you'll find that more and more people are going into apprenticeships and things is because ultimately people from a lower socioeconomic background are being priced out of university as it is. Ultimately, even before you put in debt, you put in tuition fees, going to university is an extremely expensive experience, one which for most of us get backed by our parents. And so once you actually put that into the whole idea of going into university and then add on top of that this already expensive experience, the tuition fees, it becomes absolutely impossible for some people.
But I apologise if I do come across quite blunt, but life itself is not a cheap experience. Whether you go to university or not, the fact is things are going to be expensive. You're going to make it on your own. Things are going to be expensive. I mean, it's going back to as well the point that I believe David Cameron's outlined in his speech today about potentially cutting off or limiting benefits for people who are under 25, that sort of thing. The thing is, people are always going to find a big transition between where they're looked after, in a sense, by their parents and when they're going into real life. And university is an expensive experience. I say for anybody, the fact that you're going to have to pay the fees back, that's always going to be there, but it's an investment in your future, not looking at your past. And ultimately, it's negligibly different to the same sort of financial circumstance you'd experience if you were not to go and were to try and go into real life, as it were.
I'm glad you brought this up, Luke, because I think there is a big connection between these figures from UCAS and our benighted leader's statements about cutting benefits for under 25s. As David Cameron says, he wants to make it so that under 25s must either earn or learn. They must put something into the pot before they can take anything out of the pot, which is utterly nonsensical from the stance of a welfare state. But we'll leave that for a debate for another time. I think what the issue is that the under 25s are already in a very precarious position in terms of their options. If you're an 18-year-old, you've been hit very, very hard by the 2008 financial crisis and the years of recession that followed it. You've been, you're facing a very hostile job market, which skills matter, and you just don't have the skills because you're young, you're new to the experience. You're facing a very hostile housing market. It's very difficult to go out and get your own house. More and more people living with their parents until they're 25 now. You're facing then a lot of very difficult options, a lot of societal pressures. Again, a lot of middle class people feel they have to go to university. And I take your point on that, Luke. Maybe not all of them do need to be here, and maybe we need to have a think about that. But if you look at the alternatives that are available, I think it's not surprising, again, that university fees are bouncing back a bit. I mean, it's not surprising that people are finding that there just aren't jobs, that there just aren't apprenticeships available. Apprenticeships are rising, but we still have a very low rate compared to much of Europe, for instance. It's not a good position to be an 18 to 25 year old is the sad fact at the end of the day. And I think university is proving to be an attractive option for that reason.
I'd simply say more generally than that, that things are going to be difficult for 18 to 25 year olds unless we can somehow find a way of sorting out the economy and turning this around. And we're not going to be doing that by subsidising students, a number of which may well in the future be able to afford these 9,000 fees if they're getting a good job, and subsidising that with money that's coming from people who may not have gone to university themselves. Because ultimately, we talk about a rise in fees. We're actually talking about less money coming from the government in order to subsidise those fees. Of course, government money is people's money. And I think that's a point worth noting as well, and something that underlies the whole decision and the reason why the funding was reduced anyway.
My second question then on the back of this is, should a government, future government, cut or abolish tuition fees? And if so, how should universities be funded in their place?
I think they should be publicly funded. I think we've nothing to fear from a big state. My argument against the sort of big state, small state debate has always been arguing for a big state or a small state is like arguing for a big hospital or a small hospital. You don't want a hospital of a given size. You want a hospital that's effective, that serves the right function. I think that universities provide a critical function in the social makeup of our culture. They educate people. It's not just about creating useful little people to slot into an economic block. It's not about providing skilled workers, even. It's about enriching people's minds. It's about bringing people to the line of employment that they want to get involved in. I do get quite romantic about this stuff, and it's not just because I have been here for donkey's years. So I think there should be some level of public funding. I think you have to look at the level of economic viability, which means that there is likely to be some sort of individual level subsidised by the student loans arrangement. But it needs to be much less than the £9,000 figure that it is now. And it needs to be supported by rigorous progressive taxation. You know, and in the longer term, we need some sort of glorious revolution. We need to live in anarchist syndicates. But, you know, that's just getting into my own personal utopian vision. So we'll leave that out for now.
I think, David, it's very easy to get lost in nostalgia, but we need to look at the real world here. And that is one in which we do not have the money to, I disagree with morally on the concept of progressive taxation, but you know, we do not have the money in the real world in an economic crisis. I don't know if any of you saw the Money Week video, which is basically saying, you know, just the sheer scale of the debt that we're actually in. You know, we can't afford to be churning money back into a system that had what helped to cripple the economy in the first time round. And so we need to, you know, if we're going to talk seriously about this, but we need to see where is this money going to come from in a city. You know, we can't really, you know, tax particularly people who are struggling anyway in an economic crisis. You know, 10 years time, 20 years time, 30 years time, potentially, when the economy is really, really improved, we can think about maybe hiking down the fees, you know, by a grand or two, but nothing on the scale you're suggesting.
Okay, here's the thing. Well, my opinion is actually, yes, there does need to be a requirement to hike down the fees. But what you have to do is you have to offset that by getting rid of a load of universities, which, we're quite honest, in this country are crap, basically, and do not fulfil a necessary requirement to their students. I have friends who go to universities and study the weirdest degrees in their world, and they're not going to have any correlation to the jobs that they have when they leave that university. So what you need to do is you need to cut tuition fees, but at the same time cut the amount of universities, so you have good universities doing their job better, and in turn you increase apprenticeships, like Luke said.
Well, I thought things were going so well, Rod, first of all, and then you started talking about putting the tuition fees back down again. You've disappointed me. So
in the very long future, I think the economy's really improved.
Well, all I'd say is that certainly at the moment, I think the ultimate problem with the university is that you can't guarantee a system where you pay for people theoretically to come into university, they get a degree, they come out and they become productive, because for the reasons you've mentioned, that's not possible, that's not happening.
Good luck with your criminology degree.
That's that's not what's happening in the current system with the range of degrees that we have at the range of universities we have, where ultimately we're just talking about some sort of graduate inflation. We've got more and more graduates chasing more and more, or less and less, rather, graduate jobs. It's not going to work like that. Now, if we were to see a system where we were to cut the amount of universities that we had, and we could almost guarantee that people came in would come out and make that productive contribution to society, maybe I would liberalise myself. Maybe I'd say, yeah, let's pay for them all. But until we get that, I don't want to be paying for certain people just to have a nice experience at university. I don't think that's what the state's money should be for.
I've never heard so much elitism in my life. I mean, the idea of cutting out good universities from bad universities, keep the Russell Group, what, put them back to the polys, turn them into these, apprenticeship fora, I don't know. But I think it's very, very elitist to say what is and what isn't a good university. We can talk about courses. We can talk about courses studying, for instance, David Beckham's hairstyle and all of that. Yes, there are nonsense courses out there, quite frankly. And yes, we need to have a conversation about that. But we need to be fair about this stuff, and we need to recognise what education is. I don't think education is amenable to market conditions at the end of the day. It's not a market. And I think we have to invest. It's our civic duty to invest in future generations, in education. And that means that we do need to get involved in some tax. And if we do need to do that, then we need, as Rod said, not to put the pressure on people who are already struggling so hard under the course of the recession, but we need to put that onto the multimillionaires, onto the people at the top, which is why we need a progressive taxation system.
It is absolutely not elitist to get rid of a whole load of universities that do not fulfil their opportunities. In fact, I think it's hypocritical, and I think it's damaging for us to actually to kid a whole generation of students into believing that what they're doing is right and is going to help them get a job. And in the meantime, actually, it's worthless and ultimately going to straddle them with £20,000-£30,000 of debts, when actually they could be using the skills that they need in a much more effective way, instead of spending 3 years at a useless university whilst the rest of us suffer a degree inflation, like you said, which ultimately gives our degree less worth.
All I would add to that, David, is to say that there's a difference to be had in a debate that is about the state of university generally, in a place where people can pay for the education they want. Because ultimately, despite some of the problems that have been mentioned, I think it'd be much harder to argue against a system where people voluntarily use their money to fund a university degree at a university that's ultimately not going to cause society much help. But if you're talking about funding those university degrees and those people out of the public purse, that's very different. That's not elitism. That's simple common sense.
But who decides? That's my question. Where do we draw the line? I think we need to have an enlightened discussion. We don't need to just say, oh, all those former polys, we need to get rid of them. We don't need to
I don't
to
think
say,
anyone other than you said, let's get rid of all
like
the former
polys.
Well, you
said there are good universities, there are bad universities.
Yeah, and you've assumed that they're former polys. That's not the case.
If we're going to have that national discussion, that's what it's going to come down to. Don't kid me that it's not. We're going to have the discussion, well, Nottingham's a good university, Nottingham Trent, not so great. It's good for a poly, but it's not so great in the league tables and things like that. I really like Nottingham Trent, by the way. I think it's one of the better non-red bricks. I think they have come a long way, and they will one day eclipse Nottingham University if they consider it this rate.
Very kind of you to say that.
I'd simply add that I think you'll find there's been, since the polytechs have become, and you know, you've been here 8 years, you know more than me, but you'll find just by simply looking at the league tables, there's a lot more mobility, I suppose, amongst the universities there now, and you'll see some of those leading polytechnics that are up there. But it's not just about picking and choosing universities, it's just about making sure there's a standard that must be achieved to get the degree, and ensuring that that teaching is at least got some level of consistency, to avoid what we have to agree is a case at the moment where some degrees at some universities are easier than other degrees at other universities, yet they come out with the same qualification, and in some cases somebody with one of the worst degrees or one of the less good degrees from one of the less good universities will get a higher grade than somebody who has got a better degree from a higher university. Surely you're not saying that's fair.
Well, yes, and simply I'd just say reiterating your point, Luke, that also the way, you know, the certain courses as well we have to look at, you know, look at, I'm not going to give examples, but dragon studies at wherever, you know, what are the employment rates for those courses, and we need to look at scrapping those. And actually, let's look at statistics. You can actually break these things down with statistics and say, well, let's look at the employment rates, let's look at salaries 6 months after course, and let's analyse those as well. And then we don't necessarily have to just say polytechnics, Russell groups, whatever, and break them down into those kind of groups. Let's look at the stats.
Absolutely, because actually, with first some statistics, criminology, it's the biggest bugbear of my life that people still do criminology degrees, because ultimately, there are about 20 jobs in this country that require a criminology degree. The rest of these people that do criminology degrees, which were influenced by CSI and watching The Bill too much in their youth, are actually worthless, and they shouldn't be doing those degrees, and they're merely doing that because someone thinks it's a good idea. We need to tell them that it's not a good idea and they should do something better with their lives.
As a criminologist, that's bunkum, but we'll leave that for another time.
Right, on that heated and rather personal subject-related note, we'll move on, we'll have a break, and then when we come back, we'll move on to our second topic. Hello and welcome back to The Big Picture. We'll now be discussing the very thorny and complicated issue of Syria. Civil war in Syria has been raging for well over 2 years now, leaving thousands displaced and creating a massive refugee crisis. During the summer, the Assad regime crossed the red line set out by President Obama and used chemical weapons on the Syrian people. Due to this, during the summer, the USA, UK and France made various preparations for military action. The UK, of course, there was a vote in Parliament, although the government motion was defeated, although we should point out that a second vote would have been needed before any military action took place. And while in the US, a vote was set for Congress, which would have been no doubt been very close. However, before that vote could take place, a diplomatic solution emerged almost out of nowhere. During an interview, seemingly off the cuff, remarked by US Secretary of State John Kerry, and seized upon by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, the solution was Syria surrendering its chemical weapons to the international community. Since then, a plan to do that has been formulated and potentially seems to be working. So, with all that's happened in Syria over the last 2 years, and particularly during the summer, I ask, is this diplomatic solution workable, and is it the best way the international community could respond to the crisis? But before anyone answers that, we should meet our new and changed panel for this debate. Still here is...
Kieran.
While new...
Hi, I'm Sam Peake.
And Joe Himsworth.
Thank you. Now, which one of you would first like to tackle this issue?
I'll go straight ahead. So on the issue of Syria, first and foremost, might I state that I don't think we should be intervening in this whatsoever. In terms of a solution, I don't think what David Cameron has proposed is a solution in the slightest. We can take the example of, I believe, the G20, where he was meant to take a primary role there and really ended up taking part in what seemed to be sort of a non-diplomacy, with Russia taking the lead and Vladimir Putin taking a primary role. Yes, I think he's basically ruined the entire prospect of intervention if he wanted to. He said to Barack Obama, let's go, let's intervene, let's do it, and then couldn't even get it through his own parliament. So no, I don't think the solution is working, but then again, I don't think that that we should be involved at all.
I think what's interesting about the diplomatic solution is that I hear a lot of people saying, oh, look, this is an example of diplomacy working. But this was the fact of the matter was that this was diplomacy working with a gun to the head. And I actually think that it's really important to remember that actually military might is an extremely important tool that we as the West, and kind of the moral arbiter, whether we like that or not, we kind of are, we need to use that carefully. And I think we actually used it quite effectively in this case to kind of get what we wanted.
Yes, I would agree with you, Kieran. I think the use of diplomacy is always most effective when it is backed up by military force. I think with respect to the point you raised about the G20, I think I agree with you. David Cameron was ineffective there. I accept the point that he pushed for the humanitarian assistance, but to be fair to David Cameron, he was sent there with rather no hand to play, in the sense that the Parliament obviously didn't agree with him, and therefore there is, I think, a sense that can the Prime Minister's word at the international table hold weight? And I think that's a decision that Parliament may come to regret in the future because of that point.
Yes, I understand clearly. I mean, clearly this is circumstantial to a great extent. His hands were tied to a degree, but I think that allowing Putin to, in a sense, take the reins wasn't beneficial in the slightest. And even though he was restricted in what he could do, I still think that he had room to manoeuvre.
Respect, your point seems to be quite inconsistent. In one sense, you're saying David Cameron and Britain should have nothing to do with this, we should be completely in isolation, and then simultaneously saying, but, you know, you shouldn't let Putin take the reins either. Well, either you're involved in these things or you're not.
Well, my idealistic view would be to have no involvement whatsoever, but in reality, the UK is taking a role of some form or another. Now, in that reality that we're in, you're going to have to decide what is the UK going to do. So I'm giving you my personal opinion as to what the UK's option should have been. Personally, idealistically, no, I wouldn't get involved in the slightest. But realistically, what's going on, that's my view.
I think it's also very interesting to consider what actually our vote in our House of Parliament says about where we are as a country, sort of tarnished by the Iraq War, and actually seems to suggest that we are comfortable with a post-empire Britain. And actually, I argue that this is actually a very good argument for getting rid of Trident, because it seems that we as a population are extremely comfortable with the idea of no longer being America's friend as the world policeman, you know, having a role on the world stage as a policeman. And actually, I think we seem to be much more comfortable with that. I'm just interested to know what you guys think as Tories probably in Trident. Favour. Good sentence structure there, I know.
Thank you for ascribing a political
I do my
view
best.
To me. I'm not actually a Tory, as it happens. Right. But with regard to Trident, I do... The point about Trident is, if we're ever in a position where we need to use Trident, it's failed. You know, Trident itself acts as a deterrent. So therefore, the argument that we're never actually going to need it, to me, isn't really an argument that withstands much kind of logical scrutiny, because its whole purpose is as a deterrent. And so I would personally, you know, be in favour of retaining Trident for that reason.
Well, on the first point that you mentioned in terms of our impact on the world stage, I don't believe, and I think I probably agree with you here slightly, that the UK and the US should be tied together militaristically in this special relationship. Sure, we've got this relationship, it is special, but I don't think that when the US seeks to alter certain parts of the Middle East for whatever reason, that the UK needs to be tied to that. We can be a significant power on the world stage, as we always really have been, but we needn't take this role where we're kind of the lapdog to the United States. You just look at China, for example. They're not going to war all the time, but power can be wielded in other ways, economically, for example. On your other point, very briefly, in terms of Trident weapons, I've got no particular view on this, really. I think, in particular, I take some sort of a view in thinking that nuclear weapons can't be disinvented. And this is really what Margaret Thatcher said, whether you agree with her or not, that, you know, they can't be disinvented. They're there. They're here in the world. They're going to be accessible to people. And it's what you do in those circumstances. So I think for the moment, we certainly need to reconsider the sort of way in which we have nuclear weapons. And there certainly needs to be a debate. But personally, I think keep them, probably.
Just a quick reminder to our listeners, if you have any comments or questions on anything our panel have said or are saying, remember, if you want to text us, the number is 07762212434. We can send a free web text at urn1350.net. We do look forward to hearing you. Now, my second question on the issue of Syria, we've touched on it slightly, certainly in terms of David Cameron, which is how well did Obama, Cameron and Miliband respond to and manage the situation in Syria over the summer?
I can perhaps start on this. I think, in actual fact, all three of them have come out of this looking quite sheepish. Mr. Obama's has come out of it looking quite sheepish because I think he set a red line in the sand, which was a mistake because I think it gave encouragement to the Assad regime that they could do whatever they wanted up until that red line with complete impunity. And I think that was a foolish thing to do and an off-the-cuff remark, even.
We have just got a text in, which I'll read out now. It's anonymous, so feel free and please do put your name on it if you want us to read out your name with your text. But the text reads, We need to make sure that we draw a distinction between involvement in a domestic civil war and involvement in upholding international law. The Western nations' roles should be solely limited to stopping Assad's chemical weapon capabilities, and that's all. We don't know that a Syria without Assad will be better than one with, and we shouldn't try to be tempted by it. Stop the chemical weapons and then get out. Thankfully, now, though, the negotiations underpinned by the threat of force have hopefully made that a necessary. So any comments on either that or the questioner? David, quickly.
Well, a point of clarification, really, because I know this isn't my debate. What's interesting is that Syria is one of the seven nations in the United Nations that hasn't signed the Chemical Weapons Convention, and therefore it is under no legal obligation in international law not to use them. The International Criminal Court did discuss outlawing things like chemical and biological weapons, but they were largely shouted down by member states who were poorer on the basis that nuclear weapons weren't going to be criminalized. So it's interesting that we've had that discussion about Trident and about chemical weapons. And there's an interesting question there about what international law we're upholding.
Yes, with brief reference to the person that texted it and the whole notion of chemical weapons, I think you mentioned earlier the idea of being a moral arbiter. I think it would be marvellous if the West, which I think in some senses clearly is superior to some other countries, I think if it took more of a role where morals were at the centre. I mean, we've talked about chemical weapons, and Barack Obama came forth and said that it was the dying children which persuaded him to intervene in Syria. Yet, over the past decade, the United States has also been using chemical weapons. It used white phosphorus in Iraq, even going back to Vietnam, using Agent Orange, and people are still scarred by that to this day. Indeed, Israel, I suppose you could choose with...
Is your argument that two wrongs make a right?
Not in the slightest. In terms of Israel and Lebanon at all, and I'm not bashing at all. In terms of do two wrongs make a right, no, not at all. But it's not as if we've left these things behind. And clearly we need to take a moral high ground, which I think we should do. Sort of dismissing this hypocrisy. Really.
Unfortunately, that's the great thing about being the widely accepted moral arbiter. You do get to be hypocritical. And so whilst to an extent I agree with what you're saying, ultimately, would I rather we be the moral arbiter or someone else be the moral arbiter?
Yeah, yeah.
I think we've got the upper hand on that one. But also, I think what we need to remember is that actually, yes, Obama set a red line, but actually, ultimately, this is a red line that has always been there since international law set the red line. And so I think that we did have a responsibility to act, even if that meant military force, purely to enshrine that position of the moral arbiter, purely because they had crossed a red line. Whether we had already crossed a red line,
yep.
That's kind of, it's true we did, but luckily we don't have to.
I think, to be fair here, it's pointless to start talking about moral arbiters. What's moral is always in the eye of the beholder. As regards to the position in terms of international law, the key question is, given that international law exists and has existed since the 1920s, do we enforce it? And I believe, and I do law myself, that laws, if they're going to be effective, need to be enforced. And the question that I would ask those who oppose any sort of intervention in Syria, in whatever the circumstances, is have we got nearer the position of bringing these chemical weapons under control by taking an active approach and saying we are prepared to intervene, or would we have got nearer by saying, no, let's leave it all to them to fight among themselves? I passionately believe that we've got a better chance of helping this region by being actively involved in it.
No, not in the slightest. I mean, if we learn from history at all, it will show otherwise. I mean, and I understand your point in terms of international law, but if we're going to be realistic and actually look at the two sides, Bashar al-Assad is awful, clearly. There's no denying that. But once you get rid of him, what's going to happen? Are we going to undergo statecraft? Are we going to give out democracy and liberty like sweeties in a candy shop? What's going to happen here? I mean, we already know that many sort of areas of the rebels are, you could say, jihadists. So I don't think it's sensible in the slightest to intervene.
Well, I would agree there are certain elements of the opposition, the al-Nusra, you know, element, which are not very palatable. The sad thing about this whole situation is, if we'd been in there in the first instance 2 years ago, we would have been in a position where we could have supported those pro-democracy elements. So I think the argument you've just raised is an argument actually in favour of getting in there early and trying to nip these problems in the bud rather than just leaving it on the sideline.
No, I'm talking about the here and now, and that's the fact.
I think we've kind of moved away from the point. The point was that this was not an intervention. This was not a chance for government upheaval to occur. This was actually us going in and having a strategic military strike against Assad bases in order to dismantle to an extent his military capability. And so for me, on the issue of actually intervening and going in and trying to create a whole new system of government, I completely disagree. I don't think we should be trying to do that. We've been tarnished too many times just in this century and realised that that's wrong. But actually, when it comes to the idea of strategic military strikes, I was right behind it.
The initial question, I believe, actually related to how the various political actors in this had gone about their business. And I mentioned the point about Obama. I think with regards to Mr. Cameron, he found that he really promised something that he wasn't able to deliver. And as I say, that's something that we've got to be mindful of as a nation. You know, do we want to put our prime minister in that position? And with regard to Ed Miliband, I think he may have scored. I think there's a suspicion that he played this in quite a political way, which I think in matters of war and peace is not something that is particularly healthy.
Well, we've disagreed a lot throughout this show, but I would completely agree with you here as to the nature of politicians' sort of actions. Yeah, I think those involved, Mr. Cameron, Miliband, Barack Obama, have been incredibly sheepish. And as you say, it's sort of it's playing politics with a very very serious issue. So yeah.
I mean, the best person that came out of all of this was Putin, who looked like a man who destined to win a peace prize from the scene. Seems to think so clearly. Three people there are doing things very wrong when Putin comes out of something smelling of roses.
Thank you again for another very good debate. Thank you. We are back for our final debate this evening, which is on immigration. Immigration was a perennial issue during the summer break. Right, there was the go-home vans, or both Conservative and Labour pledging tougher lines on immigration, or in fact anything UKIP said on the matter. Immigration continues to be in the sights of the major parties, and constantly in the headlines. For my first question is, do any of the parties have an effective immigration policy and a correct message on immigration? And if not, what does an effective immigration policy for the UK look like?
All I would say about the issue of immigration, it's probably not all I'm going to say. I'll probably say a bit more, but ultimately having the debate is pretty fruitless, because you can't talk about an intelligent immigration policy when you don't have control over your immigration policy. Now, I'm not being one of these raving mad let's get out of the EU sort of people. No, I'm not. David is questioning that, but I'm not. I'm just saying that as a debate goes, if you are going to talk about controlling immigration, then you can't do it when you're just talking about controlling a very small minority of the immigration. You've got to talk about the bigger picture. I'm not inviting us to talk about the bigger picture, because we've done the EU debate loads of times, but ultimately, if you are going to talk about immigration and intelligent policy, you've got to consider that.
So I should say I forgot to introduce the new and changed members of the panel, so before we go any further, they asked
Rod, first year theology student,
new to the show,
and Mike, I'm a second year history and politics student.
Joe Himsworth, still with you.
And you just heard Luke. So, sorry, anyone else want to answer the question or come back on anything Luke said?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, you can't have an effective immigration policy without the parameters being set for a policy within it. At the moment, there aren't. There simply aren't.
And what parameters would you put on that debate?
What parameters
on the policy?
So as to be able to restrict immigration slightly. Well, me being the nutter I am, I'd probably leave the European Union, for one. I can see...
been through that, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, what else? Probably simply a visa system. I mean, you look at Australia, for example, which is incredibly sensible. over the last 10 years in particular. It has been able to control its immigration. It's been able to take in those who will be beneficial for society. And I think that is the most effective way in which to tackle the issue.
Well, speaking for the left, I think that there is this issue, the perennial issue with the immigration, you're quite right, is the question of the EU, because obviously we can't control that under the law of the EU treaties. But the question then becomes, to what extent do we influence that policy? At the moment, we don't influence it very much because we don't engage with Europe. And I suppose the question is, can we engage with the European Union, especially an increasingly, ethnically isolationist European Union? You look at Germany, which has a lot of problems as they see it, with Turkish immigration, for instance. There's a lot of tension there. There's a lot of tension in much of Scandinavia, for instance. And unpalatable as I find it, I find it very problematic that, for one thing, that any discussion about immigration laws is about restricting immigration, as if there were no other options available, which was the tenor of the last general election, incidentally. It also raises the question of, well, we just assume that because we're in the EU, we can't get into it. Then there's the issue of Australia, which you admire as a very forthright, but which has incredible problems with racism there amongst its electorate. It's got a very problematic pro-white culture in that regard. And I question the extent to which we want to emulate that and whether we can have that immigration policy without those broader cultural factors coming into it.
Yeah, I think, well, if we're in the EU, obviously most of our immigration stems from the EU, so we have to put up with that if we're in the EU, and I think it's probably the better decision to stay in the EU than get out of the EU and lose that. But it's about how we deal with the immigrants, so it's about how, when they come here, are they definitely working? Are we got to keep track on them? We're keeping track on numbers from outside the EU, which is important as well, because at the moment we don't have a clue how many are coming here from outside the EU. We don't have control of our borders. We don't know how many people are actually in this country, and what we need to do when they get here, need to keep, especially for, there is a proportion from outside the EU which we can tackle, and we can actually focus them on the ones that do come to our country. Need to benefit our country. They're coming to our country, they're coming here to help us. They're helping themselves, but they're helping our country is going to benefit from them, and that's what we need to make sure we do.
With reference to the point made before that in terms of Australia, clearly I don't know the country particularly well, never been, but if there is this sort of cultural racism, to what extent does that move into the kind of official political sphere, and to what extent does it influence legislation, or does legislation influence that? Clearly, this debate is going to be far broader than what we're speaking about now, but nevertheless, very important.
So you were saying, but what are the details of those things you're suggesting? What exactly? How are you going to decide who comes in, who comes out? Are we talking criminals? You know, how are you going to work it? What are you working here?
Well, I've not set up a manifesto. Right?
No, I know. I'm not asking for that. I just want some, you know.
General ideas. A visa system would be, I think, hugely beneficial, and things generally along that line. So that, I know restrict isn't a very nice word, but you can't clearly have unlimited immigration.
No, I'd agree with that. And yeah. The actual question was, do you agree with any of the parties? And I say, well, I actually agree with a hybrid of their ideas. I'd say that, you know, the Liberal Democrats have, it's controversial to agree with the Liberal Democrats, they understand that, but you know, they're saying let's focus immigration and rather getting criminals out of this country. That's a very sound point. But also Theresa May, for example, her looking at actually who we're counting in and who we're counting out, both the Tory and Labour governments in the past, I'm talking pre-coalition, made the huge grave mistake of actually not documenting who was coming in and who was coming out. That's a start. Let's talk about that. That's a real that's the real problem that's you know, facing us here, not the kind of Daily Mail rhetoric we've been going on about before.
Well, I think that Ed Miliband's come up with a policy over the past few weeks where I think it's a step in the right direction, especially from Labour, who I feel got out of control on immigration last time round, and to make it enticing for a business to, when they take on someone from outside the European Union, they have to train up one of the British workers. That sort of helps. That helps our young people who are unemployed, and it helps the business. That helps the business twofold. They get someone who they need from outside the EU, and they also train up a British worker, which helps Britain as a country and at the people on the unemployment benefits. So it's a step in the right direction, but it's going to be, I think that's all it is. It's a tough thing to solve.
I think an issue with immigration as well, everybody always puts it in very nationalistic terms, and that's perfectly understandable because, you know, this is our home, we live here, and we want to feel as if we have some ownership over it politically, culturally, civically. But I think there's an interesting issue to the extent that immigration is such a problem for us because emigration is such a big problem for British people, because very few British people, comparatively speaking, do emigrate to work overseas. They don't take advantage of the free movement of persons provisions in the European Union Charter, for instance, to travel abroad to work overseas. I mean, we had a bit of that during the 1980s in the days of the poll tax. My parents, amongst them, moved to Germany and then to the Netherlands in order to avoid basically a crushing, swinging tax. But I think there is scope for that, and there is, again, it's part of, I think, our reticence as a nation, our Euroscepticism, that we don't take account of that. Our failure to learn foreign languages, it goes as basic as that. Our inability to speak anything other than English as a culture, and, you know, I can't speak anything other than English except for a smattering of German and Dutch, but it is a problem, and I think that colours the debate as well.
And I just add to that by saying, and the best way we can integrate with those cultures and you know, promote emigration is by staying in the European Union.
Final question, as we haven't got much time left, is immigration as important an issue as it's claimed to be, and will it be as significant in the 2015 election?
Well, yeah, it's going to be hugely important. The first point to make is that it has a huge effect on our society, as everyone can clearly see. Both in the sense of our services and in a cultural sense. But more to the point, the sort of sudden rise of UKIP on the political scene over the last, I don't know, 5 years or so, Rod's shaking his head, who I don't entirely agree with. But in terms of, with reference to the question, I think certainly that's going to, provoke some movement from the other party, certainly.
I'd just say that I think there's a big difference between the actual importance of immigration and between the perception that people have of the importance of immigration. I'll be honest, the actual figures of how much immigration affects things like jobs and benefits, etc., I don't know, so I wouldn't comment on that. What I would say is that as long as people see immigration as being an issue, it is going to be big in the election. And either people decide to tackle immigration however they do that, I think we've concluded that there's certainly no easy way of doing it, or they do try and change people's minds and they try and point out that it's not such an issue. As I say, I don't know what the full answer is, but it's a point worth making.
Immigration is one of those things where it affects people on the ground. So it's people in constituencies, in societies. Politicians might be they're departed from it because they're not like Gordon Brown. He didn't know. He wasn't there. Where he wasn't in the societies. On the ground in the estates that have segregation, where people thousands of people have come in and people have moved out. That's why it's such a big thing, because in society, you're the people who are the electorate bumping into, like, they're the ones who their society has changed. They've seen their shops close, and they've, for right or wrong, they've seen Polish shops grow. That's what it is. Whereas they like it or not, it's on the ground. It's such a big thing for the electorate.
Yeah, I think it is definitely a serious issue. But the we need to decide exactly on what grounds we talk about the issue, because, as I mentioned previously, there's Daily Mail rhetoric and then there's serious discussion that you're yeah. talking about, Mike. Yeah. And I think the problem with it is that this election is going to be about how many Polish people are there who have, you know, maybe, you know, cooked a duck off the pond once, you know, talking about individual Daily Mail yeah. stories which don't bear true to reality. Mm. And the debate has to be about, you know, how are we going to cap immigration sensibly and safely without ruining people's lives on both sides, both the European perspective and the worldview and the British perspective?
That is all we have time for today on today's show. Thank you very much for all the panel, for every debater. Please join us next week for our party conference special. But until then, we leave you with You Make Me by Avicii. Thank you for listening.